The average American spends up to 6 hours a day on computers or other screen devices, much of it using social media. Such networks have added important opportunities for information sharing, have generated enormous amounts of data, and not incidentally, have created enormous wealth. At the same time, there seems to be a wild west of security, privacy, behavioral, social, and political issues surrounding media use that we're trying to address without compromising the benefits. We'll talk to some experts about the virtues, issues, and challenges of social media just ahead on Media Meet. This is WNMU's Media Meet. I'm Bill Hart. Our guests are Northern Michigan University Extended Learning and Community Engagement Vice President Steve Vandenhoven, Michigan State University Associate Professor of Media and Information Emily Rader, and IBM Security Strategist Keith Glendon. Now, welcome.
Thank you.
First, a little background on the panel with this brief foreword. Social media is defined as a class of digital technologies that allow for the sharing of information, ideas, and other forms of expression via virtual communities and networks. So we know what we're talking about here. Steve, please tell us briefly about your division and how it intersects with concerns regarding social media.
Sure. The division's called Extended Learning and Community Engagement. It's focused primarily on online learning, but on alternative formats of learning, including, you know, virtual reality. And we're trying to push the limits of the learning process using various media. In essence, you know, the university represents a unique situation with regard to social media. We've got, you know, 7,500 young people all in the same area, all using some form of social media throughout the day, sometimes including in class. And so it presents a unique set of challenges for the university. On the other side, we also have a number of faculty members who are doing research on the impacts of social media on children, on families, on the culture overall. Right. And then we were, and we'll probably talk about this soon, we're engaged in a major effort to build our credit and non-credit programming in cybersecurity. And Keith knows a lot about that process and has been involved in these projects to make sure that the information that we exchange through social media challenges and in other ways is protected.
Okay. And that's actually a part of a state effort. I understand Northern Michigan University is one of six hubs around the state related to the cybersecurity mission.
Yes, yes. We are one of six cyber hubs, so which is part of the Michigan Cyber Range, where people can come and either learn, test, or train. So if you want to learn about something about cybersecurity, either personally or for your business, you can come to the hub and we'll have educational opportunities for you. If you're a business and you want to train your employees on a particular security solution that you have, you can come to the hub. Okay. Or if you're a business and you think you have a solution and you want to test it out, you can come to the hub. The hub and the Cyber Range are sort of like a secure internet. They're an internet that's separate from the regular internet. So you can come and test your skills and train or test solutions in a secure environment so that you don't negatively impact the actual
internet. That's really interesting. Keith, you held a lot of positions related to the digital world, solutions architect in e-business and computing, consulting for global and Fortune 100 businesses. How much of that work is tied to cybersecurity? I imagine quite a bit.
So that's why you invited me on the panel. My wife thought it was because I was an addicted social media user.
Oh, okay.
So I've been in technology for 20 years, and social media is kind of an evolution. I would almost call it, rather than social media, social evolution when you look at it from the standpoint of humans and how we use technology. But we'll talk that more. Mm-hmm. Day to day, I work in cybersecurity. That's my focus right now. For the last 5 years, I've been leading strategy and business development for IBM Security. So my day to day job is all about cybersecurity, and you know our mission is to keep the world safe. I spend my day job doing that, and I also devote a lot of my time to working with the university, with K-12 schools, doing things to elevate awareness of cybersecurity, of security and privacy, and of the issues that are associated, because it's a huge issue, not only for an individual, as a user and protecting your identity, sure. but for us as a species, as we evolve.
That's a good way to look at it. Emily, as our collective digital footprint has grown, you've not only helped design and evaluate applications, you've researched the problems that arise from socio-technical systems. What drew you to those sorts of considerations, and what are the core topics of your concern?
So I actually first started getting interested in privacy when I moved to Chicago for a couple of years after I got my PhD, and I had a friend that came to visit me who was asking me, hey, what are all those cameras on the street that have that blue light on them? And they're actually the city of Chicago's security camera network. And I was like, huh, when I first moved here, nobody actually told me about the security cameras or asked me if I consented to being on the security cameras. And so that really got me started thinking about how hard it is for people to make choices about the information that they want systems to have about them, the information they want to share or not share about themselves.
Yeah.
So for me, I think about it kind of as an information management problem, but I also feel like it has really huge implications for things like interpersonal relationships and security and safety and like democracy and freedom and all these really big sort of concepts that are important to us.
I understand. Social media precursors date back to electronic bulletin boards and message forums that developed about the time the PC was coming about. Now billions of people worldwide use social media services. What do we mean technically by a social network? And the question that keeps coming up in things I read is there something in the architecture or infrastructure itself that makes what might be sensitive information vulnerable to theft or disclosure? That is, there something in the medium itself that,
well, I mean,
that
certainly,
makes that
certainly
risk
the,
a part of it?
The technology enables much greater access to information about you than previously. Social networking is not new. We've been socially networking, as a species for
right.
This, as long as we've existed. But the power to be able to reach into the network of data that is now stored somewhere,
mm-hmm.
And the fact that that data is now connected to technology that is able to be compromised, that you can access, allows us to much more easily potentially exploit that data, have access to information about you that you might not want us to know, but that you have shared thinking it was safe over here. But because of the virtue of technology and how networks are connected, mm-hmm. could be compromised. So inherently, yes, I guess is the answer
and
to your question.
Vulnerability is increased by the fact by just matters of scale, right?
Huge matters of scale. I mean, yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Emily, you've put a lot of effort into understanding what you call derived data. We're just talking about that indirectly. Can you explain the concept and its significance?
Yeah, so derived data is basically new information and new insights that can be inferred based on data that the system explicitly collects. So by combining lots of large data sets, it's possible to basically learn new things about people that they didn't actually know that they were revealing in the first place. So an example of this, if you use Google Maps on your mobile phone and it's turned on and you're sharing your location, and then you drive back and forth between home and work, you might be aware that sort of Google Maps knows your location, but the derived data part of that would be, well, Google also, by looking at your activities over time and by combining that information with the information other people are also giving to the system, it's actually possible for Google to infer where you live and where you work and where you drop your kids off at daycare or where your kids go to school or where you go to church without you ever having to explicitly tell Google about those locations. So it's possible basically by combining the large data sets to learn new things that people don't necessarily know that they're revealing about themselves.
What about devices that eavesdrop, even though that's not their primary purpose?
Well, I sort of feel like everybody's had that experience where you might be talking to somebody and then you start sort of seeing ads that seem like they're related to that thing that you were just talking about. I kind of feel like it's probably not really practical for Google or Facebook to actually be listening in on your conversations. But it's likely that, like, maybe you're actually searching on Google for the same kinds of things that you're talking to people about in your lives. And so in that way, because you've searched for something, then it's possible to infer that you're interested in it and then maybe show you similar kinds of things that other people who search for those things that are interested in similar things to you. So it's basically like, I don't necessarily believe that people are literally being eavesdropped on by their phones or by social media. But I do believe that by these sort of digital traces that we're leaving behind as we use the web, it's effectively the same thing. It's possible to learn a lot about a person.
Okay. I saw you use an example of Alexa once, I think.
Of Alexa?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that's a little bit different. That basically, I just had to actually turn mine off. I have one in my office. And when I said Alexa, it started listening to me. That's technology that's actually designed to be listening in because you need to be able to say a word to activate it. And so it has to be listening all the time to know if you've said that word. Now, the way the technology works is it's not supposed to actually send any of your content to the network until you've said the wake word. That's sort of how people are giving the signal that they want with the next thing that they've said to be listened to. But as I just demonstrated unintentionally, it can be activated when you're not expecting to activate it.
Okay.
I think what's interesting,
go ahead.
Is a lot of these data not only can tell someone about who you are currently, where you live and where you work and where you might drop your kids off at daycare.
And how much you make and that
right.
sort of thing, yeah.
But, you know, you couple that with the field of predictive analytics and these data can be used to predict where you might go in the future or things that you might be interested in next week or vacations that you might want to take, which all feeds into the whole field of marketing and advertising as well. So I find it really interesting that people can know not only what you are or who you are right now, but they can also anticipate your behavior. Future self, yes, and your future behavior.
Okay. And to tie this concept of derived data into how does it apply to everyday cybersecurity, yeah. You know, a lot of people think about it and go, well, what hacker is going to come after me? Why would that happen? I'm just Steve, right? But if I were a hacker and I wanted to hack Northern Michigan University, I might start with Steve because I might say, well, I'm going to search LinkedIn and find out a list of people who are executives with Northern Michigan University. And then I'm going to cross-reference that with a list of Facebook data and figure out who among those pool of executives seems to be really open and frivolous about their use of social media. I'm not saying you are. But then we might be able to say, well, this person looks like a likely target, and I see that they go every week and check in at Contrast Coffee at 7 in the morning. So I might go and sit there in the corner of Contrast Coffee with a device that has a proximity reader that could actually read his badge, for example. I know he comes in there with his badge. I sat there and watched him, and so I get close to him. In my backpack is a proximity reader. It scans that device. Now I've got a copy of Steve's badge. And I have access to whatever Steve may have access to at the university physically. So now maybe I can get into CoHotus, and maybe I can get from there into a network, an empty office where I can plug into the network. Now I'm on the network. Now I can start scanning the NMU network. So the idea that social media is going to directly lead to, you know, Steve being hacked isn't as necessarily realistic as it is that hackers may use a cyber criminal, I should say, yeah. may use your vector as an open door to get into something they're trying to accomplish, right? So that's one of the interesting dangers of social media is that, and it's not just social media in and of itself, but just all of our use of all technology in a modern world.
And I think what's particularly interesting is social media, as you know, is mainly a young person's activity. Although Facebook is ours now because right. they've given it up to us. But you know, Instagram and Snapchat are definitely sure. younger person's social media outlets. And Keith and I are working on this with regard to the cybersecurity project, in that at least my children can be pretty loose about their use of social media. They don't pay much attention about the content of what's going through the network, nor where they are, nor who might be around them. They're interested in free Wi-Fi, and so they'll plug into Wi-Fi no matter where they are. And so you've got people who are really attached to this, to social media, who may not use even the most basic cybersecurity measures to protect. And as Keith said, they provide an open window to get into larger systems, not just their data, but into larger networks.
Okay. The Facebook people still have the numbers. Top social media companies, companies with over 100 million users, number only around 25. Maybe that's a lot. I'm not sure. The biggest by far is Facebook with over 2.2 billion. YouTube with 1.9 billion. WhatsApp with 1.5 billion. And then we get WeChat and Instagram, which is also a Facebook product, isn't
right.
it?
Yeah.
Okay, and they're about a billion users. So, but it's definitely shifting. It's showing in the Facebook, apparently it's showing in the number of users for Facebook too, that they're climbing a little bit. But what accounts, what accounted for, I should say, the enormous popularity of Facebook among all the, you know, all the 25 that reach over 100 million people?
I mean, I'm not sure I'm an expert in what accounted for that popularity, but from a personal perspective, mm-hmm. I can say that, you know, one of the very basic things that appeals to me as a Facebook user is its convenience in my life. And I think that's what holds us there as users to any social media. It brings a certain convenience in connecting with those we care about. Mm-hmm. It brings a certain convenience. For example, I think about my kids when they grow up and I'm dead and gone. Right, I don't have time in my life to sit and make a photo album and carefully plot out what we did in our lives. But with Facebook, one is dynamically created. You know, as I go, I can just take a picture of us at what we were doing that day, and there it is. And I'm going to be able to give access to my kids not only in the form that you know it as today, but where technology is going, we will be at a place in their lifetimes where they can just plug in and ask the question of the AI, what was Dad doing on December 34th, right?
Yeah.
I'm talking in the future, there will be a 34th in December. But, you know, what was Dad doing on this day? And it will the AI will serve that data up, right? And won't that be an interesting thing? So to me, that I find that really appealing. Now, not everybody does, but I think that's really kind of cool because I'm interested in my ancestry. And when I do genealogy research, there's nothing, right? Maybe there's one or two little bits or pieces of my history. But in future generations, their whole ancestry will be available to them in the form of not only pictures and images, but videos and eventually more than that.
Okay. And from my perspective,
I actually have to say that particular future kind of terrifies me a little bit, to be honest. Because of all of the things that AI will have to know about you to be able to provide you what you want. And then, you know, just the whole idea of DNA databases and the fact that when you contribute your genetic information to one of these things, you're actually also revealing information about your family members that may not necessarily want to be in that database. So, but getting back to your question about sort of why is Facebook so popular, I actually think that part of that is just timing, right? They hit the market at the right time when there wasn't a lot of competition. And at this point, because everyone's on it, there's a lot of cost to switching to something else. So there's just kind of a network momentum effect that's going on.
Yeah, okay. I was going to mention the same thing.
And, you know, Facebook is designed to be engaging. So they were first in the market, and so obviously there are advantages to that. And then they've made some very strategic decisions, I would assume, to make Facebook as engaging as possible so that you spend more time on it. And I think they've succeeded in that. I don't think it's by mistake that they're at the top of the list.
People appear to be, maybe they're not any longer, but it seems that people appear to be very naive about some of these things. One thing, an important feature of social media is that users are developing the content. And that sets up some interesting questions, both practically and ethically. That content's the lifeblood of the system, but it's essentially free to the people who are generating it. But it has to be paid for, and the question is, who's the primary customer?
Yeah. Well, it's a very good question.
In Facebook, it turns out to be hundreds of companies that would like to use this data, right?
Sure. Yeah. And the other side of that is you've got, Facebook or any other social media provides a platform to reach customers or potential customers that wasn't heretofore available. And so, to give you an example, I have a friend who has a little business, and he uses YouTube to create content to put it out there, and I mean, his particular line of expertise.
Okay.
And he's just giving free content on YouTube and then putting that up on Facebook and then taking advantage of the social, social media connections to draw customers to his website and thereby creating a market. And he's made himself a successful entrepreneurial venture that wouldn't have been possible without the advent of social media. So, there's both sides of that. It's both dangerous but also empowering.
Well, that brings us to what's called data mining, which is assembling user history and information into profiles that can be used by or to market various goods and services. That's what monetizes social media. What sorts of data we talked a little bit about that. Let's go to another question. What information are users given about what's being collected and who gets it?
Yeah, in my experience, they're being given a lot, but they're not paying attention to it.
Okay.
So disclaimers are there. People sign user agreements all the time, and we've become so accustomed to clicking the button on the user agreement so that we can get to download the software that we don't really even look at what's in there. And when we do, it's far too complex for the individual consumer to really digest and understand. Yeah.
Emily, there's been a lot of research done at MSU to bring that fact to light, that people don't really read the fine print. Is that significant in what you're finding?
So I feel like the whole model of asking people for upfront consent like that is broken. It's not a very good way to manage privacy. One of the problems with that is that you're usually asked to agree or not before you've actually used the thing that you want to use. And so you don't really know what kinds of data are actually going to be collected. It's not like the privacy policy describes to you how you're going to be using that application and integrating it into your life. So you don't really know exactly what it's going to collect and what you're going to want to reveal to it. But also, those privacy policies typically talk way more about the types of data that are collected, but they don't talk about how that data might be used to derive new data or specifically about who might actually have access to that data. There was just a news story that I saw this morning about how Facebook has been providing audio recordings to third-party contractors, I guess, so that they can transcribe that audio if people opt in to having their messages transcribed. But it doesn't say anywhere in the privacy policy or the terms of service that there's going to be third-party contractors that are human beings that are going to be actually transcribing this audio. And if one of the people that you're chatting with has opted in and you haven't, then your audio is still going to get transcribed. So I feel like there's a lot to be desired in this sort of upfront consent model.
The Federal Trade Commission recently fined Facebook $5 billion for violating privacy via third-party information access. They laid down some conditions. Now third-party applications will find it harder to get your data. Facebook will need your active consent to keep facial recognition data. Facebook can't use your phone number for its advertising business without your consent, and Facebook must immediately notify authorities when data has been compromised, and they have to tell you what steps they've taken to respond. Does anything stand out there for us about that ruling? Anything especially significant?
To me, what's significant about that is it's an instance of legislation and policy trying to keep up with technology. Yeah. And the challenge we have today is that we're in this point of technological evolution that's going so fast, and compute power is so great, and the types of data that we collect and can correlate are so complex that sometimes even those who are driving the algorithms don't understand how it's doing that. So how do you expect to regulate that? And so you have things like GDPR in Europe where they are attempting to regulate, and we've seen some of the big fines in Europe. That
in
will
Europe,
help.
It's very comprehensive.
Sure, it is. And that, comes down to data, individual data ownership, and you as a company have to prove that if I say get rid of that data, you've done it.
Right.
But how do you regulate that, and how do you police that? And so we are going to be in a position, we as a human society, mm-hmm. of regulatory and policy trying to keep pace with technology from now on.
That's, I think we're going to need a younger Congress, for one thing. But the fact is, the U.S. does not have a comprehensive data protection law. So there's not much teeth or deterrent in the response we can give.
Right.
The FTC is not set up to do this, hand out these kinds of judgments, really. Assuming it's fair, what should a law like such a law contain? Do you think? Should it look like the general data protection regulations for the EU, or what should it look like?
It's a question I'm not really prepared to ask. I mean, that's
okay.
a big question.
Emily, you have an opinion there?
So I'm not a lawyer. I've never been trained in the law. But I think one of the big differences between the GDPR and the approach that we take in the United States is that the GDPR is sort of based on this idea that data that are about you should belong to you, and you should have control over those data. Whereas in the United States, data that are about you are typically considered to be owned by the company that holds the data. And so that company can basically do whatever they want with it without asking you for permission for it. And I think that that difference in sort of values or philosophy about data ownership is actually really, really important. And I would love to see in the United States a shift more to thinking about that data as belonging to the person that it's about rather than to the company.
Okay. That's a good point, and that is the direction the U.S. is heading. If you look at California, for example, who's following very closely with the GDPR precedent, and you know, data ownership, and also I guess I would add to that the importance of putting the onus on organizations using your data to prove that they have in fact given you that ownership, versus today the onus is on the individual to discover, oh, my data has been compromised or used in a way that I didn't mean it to be. We need to sort of flip that and have more.
It seems to be acting, to borrow another piece of work that Emily did. It seems to be borrowing from this notion that privacy doesn't have any particular value to the individual, where it previously it was just the opposite, right?
Technology has an interesting way of leading us down the direction of privacy being dead, and in a lot of ways, it already is.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying. We can lock the barn, but there's no horse in it.
That's
okay.
True.
Okay.
I feel like privacy isn't necessarily
about 10
dead.
Seconds. Go ahead.
People still don't want someone watching them when they go to the bathroom, for example. So there's still information people want to protect. I don't think privacy's dead at all.
Okay, good. We've been talking about social media and issues surrounding it with Northern Michigan University Extended Learning and Community Engagement Vice President Steve Vandenhoven, Michigan State University Associate Professor of Media and Information, Emily Rader, and IBM Security Strategist Keith Glendon. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you all.
I'm Bill Hart. Thanks for joining us on MediaMeet.
The preceding program was produced in studios located in the Edgar L. Hardin Learning Resources Center by WNMU-TV, Northern Michigan University Public Television.